morning. My name is Michael McCusker. The two-day war that lasted 6 years ended tomorrow, 75 years ago. Actually, there are two Victory Over Japan days. The first was on August 14th, 1945, when the actual shooting and bombing stopped. The second VJ day was September 2nd that year, when the formal surrender was signed aboard the American battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Harbor. So it might be historically correct to claim World War II started on September 1st and ended on September 2nd, 1939 and 1945, respectively. I dedicate today's program to Joyce Vandervoort, who was a 12-year-old schoolgirl living in Honolulu, Hawaii, with her U.S. Navy parents when Japanese airplanes attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941. She was seriously wounded, most likely by falling steel from anti-aircraft guns shot at the attacking Japanese. But all her life, she thought it was a bomb. She never fully recovered, though she lived to age 83. She spent the final 5 decades of her life in Astoria, Oregon, dying on Thanksgiving Day, 2012. And that is the subject of today's program, At War in Astoria. And it is something I have written. And on a couple of occasions, some versions of it read on this program. Man is born, suffers, and dies, is the legendary crystallization of Egypt's long ancient history, and might elliptically be the essential story of humanity. The German Count Gottlieb von Hassler enlarged the thought toward the end of the 19th century when he said, unconsciously anticipating the world wars of the 20th century, "It is necessary that our civilization build its temple on mountains of corpses, on an ocean of tears, and on the death cries of men without number." The most significant fact about the 20th century that clutters the near past preceding this new millennia like an old junkyard is its mountain of corpses, laid out at civilization's temple as the manifest purpose or preferred outcome of its spectacular scientific and technological creations. At the very heart of the temple are the death camps, whose names, Auschwitz, Buchenwald, Treblinka, Dachau, will most likely cause a shudder up through the centuries. Simultaneously, the purpose of splitting the atom to obliterate large numbers of the human species might cause future humanity to regard its modernist ancestors at least as barbarously as current era millennium humans think our cave-dwelling forebears. 20th century warfare was on a scale so colossal that all other wars combined do not equal those fought in previous centuries. The scale of World War II was enormous. War historian John Keegan wrote that it was the largest event in the history of humankind, and that no populated continent was untouched. An estimated 60-plus million human beings perished out of existence during the 6 years the war spread over most of the world. Though combatants died by the millions, many millions more civilians were killed in massive bombing raids that destroyed cities, towns, and neighborhoods, or were heinously exterminated in death camps as a consequence of their religion or race. The war's immensity of death and broken lives, which can never be enumerated with complete accuracy nor truly comprehended, were approximately 15 million battle dead, 40 million civilian dead and missing, 35 million military and civilian wounded, 28 million homeless, 35 million imprisoned, 5 million orphaned, and 11 million plus executed, most of them in death camps. American casualties in World War II were estimated at between 410,000 to 416,000 total, with 300,000 combat deaths, which coronavirus deaths are expected to reach by December 1st this year, after nearly a year of epidemic. Nearly 15,000 American prisoners of war died in captivity during World War II. Varying estimates of American wounded in the war were around 500,000. War historian Keegan wrote that the global nature of World War II meant that it was fought on a scale which even today confounds the imagination. To be understood and reachable to the individual sensibility, the war's scale must be scaled back, focused on the nearly microscopic but very personal local involvement. The Columbia River city of Astoria, Oregon, 10 miles inland from the Pacific Ocean, exemplified the war's urgent claim of total commitment of every nation swept into it, though its role was minor and supplementary compared to the large shipbuilding efforts 100 miles upriver in Portland, Oregon, and Vancouver, Washington. And, of course, like every other city in the USA, it was untouched by actual combat. Astoria was hot during World War II. Thousands of sailors came from all over the nation to fill the crews of ships built upriver in Portland and Vancouver. They were young to war, aware they might be killed, their ships sunk. So they partied in Astoria like there was no tomorrow, which for many, there were few tomorrows left. The initial effect of Pearl Harbor on Astoria was anxiety that the Japanese would attack the west coast of the USA, as so many rumors claimed. A severe blackout was imposed. Mines were laid at the entrance to the Columbia River to stop enemy ships and submarines, and incoming, outgoing friendly vessels were escorted through the minefield by small Coast Guard patrol boats. Tongue Point-based Navy PBY seaplanes patrolled the north coast from San Francisco to the Straits of Juan de Fuca. The PBYs were later replaced by Navy blimps that operated from Tillamook. Astoria's young men and women enlisted or were drafted into the armed forces, many joining the naval and maritime services, and were sent to all theaters of the war, Europe, Asia, and the Pacific. A National Guard unit from Astoria saw combat in New Guinea and the Philippines. The Navy built a 500-bed hospital for wounded servicemen, and Fort Stevens and Camp Clatsop, renamed Rilea, trained troops sent to Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. Although commercial fishing was made an immediate priority occupation in Astoria, not to be interrupted by drafting local fishermen away from the important war effort of supplying food for the armed forces, hundreds of local mariners flocked to enlist. Merchant Marine Liberty and Victory ships and Navy warships, such as the infamous Kaiser Coffins, small, thinly armored escort aircraft carriers, were built upriver in Portland and Vancouver and floated downriver to Astoria to be commissioned, made sea-ready, and crammed to capacity with crews and cargoes of weapons, war supplies, and soldiers. Fully armed and crewed, these ships steamed out through the infamous Columbia River Bar into the vast Pacific Ocean to fight in the colossal oceanic war of annihilation against the Empire of Japan, many to never return. Among many personal accounts of those first few months in Astoria after Pearl Harbor is one by Paul Barkman, who served on a Coast Guard patrol boat guarding the entrance to the Columbia River. "The river filled up with vessels of every kind," he wrote. "Ships anchored below Desdemona Light that had escaped Japanese submarines. A couple of ships were torpedoed just off the coast, but most managed to get across the bar and safely into harbor. Everything was painted wartime gray," Barkman continued. "The Coast Guard vessels Fur, Manzanita, and Rose took on a drab appearance. Sea bags began to stack up at all naval and Coast Guard stations as floods of new enlistees took berths among the huge fleet of small craft that were taken over for the duration of the war. Yachts from the Astoria and Young's Bay clubs, tugboats, and fishing boats of every sort were pressed into service and painted gray. Each received numerical designations based on their length, and most were mounted with guns." And that was Paul Barkman. Like the rest of the country, the Oregon North Coast settled into a war routine of rationing, food, gas, sugar in shoes, war bond drives, and blood banks. And very soon the War Department began sending telegrams to local families reporting the deaths of sons, brothers, husbands, and lovers. The deaths of American women grew apace of their military duties. People volunteered for the Red Cross and for air raid warden duties, worked on scrap drives, rationing, and draft boards. Robert S. Lovell wrote in the summer 1995 Comtux, Clatsop County Historical Society's quarterly magazine. Women filled most of the cannery jobs previously held by able-bodied men and helped fit out ships sent incomplete to Astoria from the Upper River shipyards. Also exempt from the draft with fishermen were local ship and boatyard workers, marine electricians, and other skilled labor necessary to produce the local portion of the stupendous war machine that America built during World War II. Forest workers were not exempt, however, and while they warred all over the world, Pacific Northwest forests were left to burn untended, except for skeleton crews of conscientious objectors, which included future Oregon Poet Laureate William Stafford. A successful effort by local Chinese school children to block shipment of scrap iron to Japan in 1940, the year before Pearl Harbor, shouldn't be lost to our memory, Lovell wrote in Comtux. Japanese atrocities in China angered the school children, who decided to picket a ship that was being loaded in Astoria. They suddenly appeared on the docks carrying signs, and our patriotic longshoremen decided to honor their picket line, Lovell wrote. The port of Astoria subsequently embargoed all further scrap shipments, which angered Japan. "They're going to be shooting that stuff at us anyway," Lovell quoted his mother as saying, a rather popular opinion at the time. The Japanese sued the port, the longshoremen, and the Chinese children. Lovell wrote, "Fortunately, the suit dragged on and was settled when Pearl Harbor was bombed. Of course, it was only 27 months later that Japan did indeed shoot at Clatsop County with 17 shells aimed at Fort Stevens." Coast Guardsman Barkman wrote of the shelling of Fort Stevens. "On the night of June 21, 1942, a Japanese submarine surfaced offshore and slammed a few shells at Fort Stevens. Everyone waited for Battery Russell to reply, but there was only silence. Afterward, the sub moved down the coast and shelled California. The Coast Guard anchored a barge off Fort Stevens and checked every vessel that went in and out of the river. Russian ships started coming in for cargo at ports upriver in large numbers, thrashing water on the way in and almost awash at the gunwales on the way out," Parkman wrote. "It was a great shock at first to see women aboard the Soviet ships as members of the crews." The Columbia River Maritime Museum on the Astoria Riverfront provides a virtual, perhaps even visceral, experience of World War II's Titanic sea battles in the Pacific between the USA and Japan, and the pitiless no-quarter submarine wars of 1914 to 1918 and 1939 to 1945 in the North Atlantic. The centerpiece of CRIM's Naval History Gallery is the steel bridge and pilot house of a U.S. Navy destroyer that experienced fierce combat in the colossal battles of the Pacific War. The museum was built around this 13-ton metal skull of USS Kanab, which, like a royal head, was detached from its body and shipped downriver from a Portland shipwrecking yard. A special corner of the Naval History Gallery is devoted to an exhibit of the heavy U.S. cruiser USS Astoria, including a model by CRIM founder Rolf Klepp. Astoria was the first of two warships named after the city of Astoria and was sunk by Japanese cruisers off Guadalcanal one August night in 1942 with three other Allied cruisers. The Battle of Savo Island was a nightmare gunfire and torpedo fight at which the Japanese excelled. Astoria, which had conveyed home to Tokyo the body of a Japanese ambassador a few years earlier, was riddled with shell hits. An all-metal, electronically guided, mechanically propelled warship engaged in the largest naval war in history, Astoria sank like an antique sailing man of war, gunned to death broadside to its enemy. 238 of Astoria's crew died with their ship. 142 were wounded. above Klepp's model is a diagram showing where each of approximately 200 Japanese shells struck Astoria. A 50th anniversary reunion of survivors was held at the museum in 1992, and the number have been held since. They gather on August 9th, the date of Astoria's sinking, and also the date of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki in 1945. The plutonium for that bomb was manufactured upriver from Astoria at Hanford, Washington. Exhibits change and rotate in the Naval Gallery. One exhibit was the model of U.S. Navy destroyer Reuben James, generally considered the first American naval vessel lost in the war, though the gunboat Panay, sunk in China by Japanese air attack in 1937, might also have a claim. The Reuben James was torpedoed by a Nazi U-boat while escorting a convoy of cargo ships to England 2 months before Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941. Its loss characterized the grim six-year battle to maintain English and Russian ocean supply lines against attacking German submarines. Thousands of ships and lives were lost, and for a perilous time, U-boats sank more Allied cargo ships than they could be replaced. The model of Reuben James seems to have sunk again, disappeared from the exhibits to the museum's Davy Jones locker. In response, American shipyards revolutionized shipbuilding, particularly the Henry Kaiser yards on the Pacific coast. By war's end, the Kaiser yards in Portland and Vancouver were producing their famous Liberty and Victory ships one a day. A classic example of a World War II Liberty ship is the Star of Oregon, which was built in Portland and launched in September 1941. It was the second Liberty launched, the first on the West Coast. A year later, on August 30th, 1942, a Nazi submarine sent it to the bottom of the Caribbean on its return to the USA from its maiden voyage to the Persian Gulf. The museum possesses a builder's model of Star of Oregon. The Kaiser yards on the Columbia River also built warships, one of which was the escort carrier Gambier Bay. Krim's collection includes a model of Gambier Bay that was built from scratch by two Beaverton, Oregon dentists, Nick Marino and Robert Norgren, who singly or together made most of the naval models in the museum. The real Gambier Bay was one of 50 small aircraft carriers commissioned and crewed in Astoria. Escort carriers like Gambier Bay were built to provide air support for amphibious operations in the Pacific or against U-boats in the Atlantic. They carried a crew of 900, which, with their air squadrons of torpedo planes and fighters, joined aboard at Astoria. They were the first all-welded carriers prefabricated to be built quickly, an average of one every 7 days. A popular name for them was Kaiser Coffins, which five commissioned in Astoria became, sunk by torpedoes, Japanese kamikazes, and one by surface fire. Paul Parkman wrote that although Astoria was generally a pleasantly quiet Liberty town, quote unquote, later in the war, when the escort carriers started coming down river from the Kaiser shipyards in Portland and Vancouver, large numbers of shore patrol and local police were called out because too many of the crews aboard the Kaiser coffins were not too optimistic about their futures and decided to tear up Astoria, which was their last American port. And that was Paul Parkman. The late Fitz Randolph Moore used to say that during the war, many Astoria parents of young daughters were secretly grateful for the large influx of prostitutes from inland cities to entertain the sailors, marines, and soldiers, which apparently helped local girls remain virgin and unpregnant. The Gambier Bay has the unfortunate distinction of being the only American aircraft carrier sunk by surface fire. It was shot to pieces by Japanese battleships and cruisers at the Battle for Leyte Gulf in late October 1944, which was the largest sea battle in history, and ended with the virtual destruction of the Japanese Navy. a spectacular victory for the U.S., despite heavy losses and serious blunders. As with the cruiser Astoria, survivors of Gambier Bay have met at the Columbia River Maritime Museum for reunions at the replica of their ship. A poignant yet routine sight of the war years in Astoria, when American servicemen crowded into the city and filled out Navy crews, aerial squadrons, and combat infantry shipped to hostile shores, was described by Paul Barton. One day in 1944, my patrol boat, 50 miles offshore, spotted a large troop ship that had come out of the Columbia River and was heading across the Pacific. We could see hundreds of soldiers staring at us or looking back at the land many of them would never see again. I thought I knew how they felt and how they must have yearned to be in my place aboard a Coast Guard patrol boat that never left or ever had a shot fired at it. The war against Nazi Germany ended May 8, 1945, with the defeat and eradication of Nazism. Its periodic resurrections in various parts of the world, including the Pacific Northwest, are as yet far out on the political fringe. The Pacific Ocean War came to a conclusion that summer, a few days after atomic bombs nuclearized two Japanese cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered to the Allies on August 14, 1945, and officially signed surrender documents aboard a U.S. battleship in Tokyo Harbor, the famous Mizura, on September 2nd. Both dates are claimed as the actual VJ Day. Robert Lovell wrote of Astoria at the end of the war, "Troop ships began passing Astoria as the soldiers came home in the fall of 1945. You could hear their cheers all over downtown as the ships slowed to change pilots. In October 1945, Astoria played host to a small fleet of Navy ships that arrived just in time to celebrate Navy Day. They came from kamikaze action off Okinawa. Then on the way here, they encountered a terrible typhoon. You can visualize how glad they were to be here." And that was Robert Lovell from Comtex. World War II played out one last act in Astoria, however. The battleship USS Missouri visited the city in the late spring of 1998. It stayed for several days before being towed to join the sunken USS Arizona as bookend memorials to the beginning and ending of America's part in the war. An estimated 125,000 people came to see the old battleship before its last voyage. Such crowds will never be in Astoria again unless, as one man suggested to the mayor, the city hosts the Olympics. Missouri left Astoria towed by a powerful tugboat, fittingly named Sea Victory, disappearing to a watchful crowd in the fog that rolled up from the river's mouth. The old battleship towered over more recent Navy vessels visiting the city before going upriver to Portland's annual Rose Festival. The moment the tug moved, Mighty Moe, toward the ocean, another famous vessel, Astoria's own salvage chief, blasted its horn in tribute. To sort of paraphrase James Michener, Americans who fought the battles of World War II will be remembered as long as their generation lives. After that, like the soldiers of the Civil War and the Revolution, they will become strangers. Longer and longer shadows will obscure them until their war sounds distant to the ear, like Shiloh and Valley Forge. And that was At War in Astoria. And now, Devil's Brood. And I wrote this. Today, August 13th, is World Left-Handers Day. Perhaps the oldest known prejudice aside from sexism and racism, the discrimination against left-handed persons, dates from primeval ages when humanity's earliest ancestors, the great majority of whom, like now, were right-handed, put food into their mouths with their bare right hands during the hundreds of millennia before the invention of crude eating utensils, and wiped away their wastes with their equally bare left hand. Obviously before invention of toilet paper. Disparagement because so few, the minority of minorities of human beings are left-handed, only 7 to 10% of the species. So up through time, goodness and godliness have been righteously accorded everything right, wickedness and evil sinisterly dumped onto the left. Yet conversely, it has been the partisan right that has produced the Hitlers, Stalins, Trumps. Left-handed folk share with other estranged exotics basic problems of inequality in a world designed with little consideration for their presence, or more sinisterly, designed to eradicate their presence in it. Not so very long ago, a reigning chairman of Clatsop County, Oregon Republicans, who wished to strip human rights from gays and lesbians, included left-handed persons as being social deviants who practiced bizarre and unusual behavior as embezzlers, cannibals, and sodomites. He later apologized for being reckless, comparing homosexuals with embezzlers and cannibals, but left lefties out of his mea culpa. KMUN community radio classical music programmer Jan Faber mocked the local GOP big shots tirade. "You have to watch out for left-handed persons," he said. "They persuade others to be left-handed. They coerce and recruit people into being left-handed. They control the media and send out subliminal codes to switch to left-handedness. They use the schools to impose their left-handedness on our children." And that was Jan Faber. Tomorrow, VJ Day, is the birthday of a left-handed woman whose natal day was August 14th, 1945, that very day. She is a grandmother. Her only son is a retired cop. Her oldest daughter is a UPS executive. Her two youngest daughters are registered nurses on the pandemic front lines. Her oldest granddaughter is a champion horsewhip. They are all American, mixed race, white, black, and Pacific Ocean Asian. And I wrote a poem to her, Julie and VJ Day. "You might have been named Victoria Jane. You knew a girl who was. Poor girl, you said. You are 75. VJ Day, the day you were born. The World War ended. Millions dead. Gone. Never more forever. You are new life, born amidst burial, a sad world you make warm. You unconditional mother, you wonderful woman. I love you always." And this is Michael McCusker. I am also a lifetime member of the sinisterly gauche tribe of wrong-sided lefties. And also, I am a lefty Leo. Remember, as the national toll of plague deaths surmounts in less than a year the Americans killed in World War II, protecting yourself protects everyone else. Real soldiers know that masking up is not unmanly, a rather stupid and sexist prejudice. Wearing a mask in public is life-saving, like breathing in and out. Happy Southpaw's Day. Lefty Lives Matter.